This is Behind the Money from the Financial Times. I'm Amy Keene. This week on the show, we're looking at Uber. Last summer, the ride-hailing app was in trouble.
Travis Kalanick stepped down from the company he helped create.
Breaking news, Uber CEO Travis Kalanick resigning overnight amid recent scandals.
Kalanick had been pushed out by Uber's board after allegations of sexual harassment had come to light. The founder and his vision for the company were gone, and Uber was facing a stream of lawsuits and regulatory battles. And now, 1 year later, and with a new chief executive at the helm, has the company that's valued at more than $60 billion managed to convince investors that it's a professional operation? Shannon, if we go back to about a year ago, what was happening at Uber?
So Uber's board had been looking for a chief executive to replace the company's co-founder and CEO, Travis Kalanick.
Shannon Bond is the FT San Francisco correspondent.
He had resigned under pressure from some of their biggest investors in June, and the company had been run in the intervening weeks by a committee of 14 executives. So the board had finally narrowed it down. They had three choices. And on Sunday, August 27th, after spending more than 2 days deliberating over their choices, they picked their candidate, Dara Khosrowshahi. And Uber being Uber, that decision leaked within a few minutes, actually before the company had even told Khosrowshahi that he had the job or before he'd even accepted it.
It hasn't really been officially announced yet, but we're pretty certain he's the candidate and the person they've offered the job to, and it's a done deal.
It was really just like the latest episode of drama coming after months and months of turmoil at Uber, in a time when the company was really desperate to sort of set a new tone and put a cap on this really tumultuous period that had gone on for, frankly, longer than 2017, but had really escalated at the beginning of the year. Uber had been criticized for years for a really aggressive approach to competitors, to regulators, and even some of the reporters who were covering it. That was kind of part of an overall tone that was set by Kalanick. I mean, people describe him as being really hard-charging, really ambitious, really inspiring in a lot of ways. I mean, he had a vision and he was going to pursue it. But he also really, it was sort of a strategy of growth at all costs. And so that could be inspirational, but it was also a real source of contention. They basically took an attitude in a lot of ways, in a lot of areas, that was not asking permission, but asking forgiveness. And often they weren't even asking the forgiveness.
For the popular ride-sharing company, it's been a terrible year.
Alphabet is suing Uber for allegedly stealing trade secrets to jumpstart its own autonomous vehicle program.
The ride-hailing giant in January kicked off the year on a sour note, reportedly losing 200,000 customers after Uber refused to strike during a protest against President Trump's proposed travel ban.
Things really went up a notch, though, in February of 2017, when a former engineer at Uber named Susan Fowler published this blog post that described this pervasive culture of sexism at the company.
This morning, Uber CEO is launching an investigation into allegations of sexual harassment by a former employee.
A former engineer is going public with what she says is a frequent problem inside Uber, sexual harassment and sexism. She describes the company as an organization in chaos.
And that's when things really started unraveling. You saw executives leaving in droves. There had already been some investigations that had been announced by various federal bodies into some of Uber's business practices. And things just sort of mounted and mounted, ultimately culminating in Kalanick being pushed out by some of his biggest investors. And then even after he actually stepped down as chief executive, the drama didn't really end there. He was embroiled in a lawsuit with Benchmark, one of the first and biggest backers of Uber, who were accusing him of fraud and were trying to actually get him kicked off the board. So it was all pretty high stakes and high drama.
So Shannon, by the time Dara Khosrowshahi walks into Uber, the company's in need of this massive cleanup. What are people thinking about this guy?
So he was the CEO of Expedia and a longtime lieutenant of the mogul Barry Diller. So Dara started his career as an investment banker at Allen & Company, where Barry Diller was actually one of their clients. He then went to work for Barry Diller at IAC, the media conglomerate. He's got a real financial background. He was the IAC CFO before being named the CEO of Expedia. He spun Expedia off from IAC. And there was also sort of the personal element. I mean, he's a family man. He comes with this experience. He's a bit older. He's a bit more buttoned down. And he was seen as kind of a contrast to not just Travis Kalanick in particular, but also that broader stereotype of sort of the Silicon Valley entrepreneur. And he wasn't actually a hugely known quantity in Silicon Valley, but he was, when he came in, he was really seen as somebody who had a steady hand, who could do a couple of things that the company really needed at that point in terms of setting a new tone, bringing a more diplomatic approach to its interactions with various bodies, including regulators, and taking the company public.
I find the Uber story a really interesting one because it's among this group of tech companies, the so-called unicorns, which are these privately held startups that are valued at $1 billion. Now, obviously, Uber has surpassed the $1 billion mark long ago, but it's part of this group of companies that has sort of defied the odds for startups. But Travis Kalanick sort of also operated with a bit of pride that he was this private company able to raise so much money and, you know, a company that didn't have to go to those public markets. I guess what has changed within the company other than a new CEO? But what has changed to make now the right time to start the sort of process of going public?
This is one of the things that the board and investors made a priority when they were looking for a new chief executive last year. They wanted the company to go public. They wanted to get a return. And so I think, you know, maybe we are coming to the end of the road for many of these companies that have gotten so big while still staying private.
And how has Khosrow Shahi performed? Has this been a good year for the company?
You know, I think when you talk to people at Uber, they do say it's a really different vibe inside the company. It's a different tone. One of the things that caught a lot of attention under Travis's reign was these values that he and a couple of the other senior executives had put together, which included things like stepping on toes and always be hustling, and it really embodied that hard charging, aggressive, combative approach to winning market share. And, I mean, one of the first things Dara did was throw that out and say, we're going to have a new set of values, and they start with doing the right thing, period. Dara is much more, he delegates. He sets the tone, he takes responsibility for the big thing, but he's built a team of people that he trusts to work through things, and it's just run in a more typical way that you would expect of a more mature company at this stage of its growth.
Like you would a sort of more traditional chief executive.
You know, I think you can say, you can look down the sort of the list of the things that Dara's accomplished, and they're real. I mean, he's had some real wins. He helped finalize a big investment from SoftBank that came with also changes in governance at the board level that were important. He's put in a bunch of top executives. He's put in a new independent chairman. He's really built out a team there. He's also, you know, dealt with regulators in ways that are a real change in tone from the previous administration. He helped win back Uber's license to operate in London. They've taken some real, you know, steps that I think people have received pretty positively. And I think that's come along with a shift. I mean, I wouldn't say their image has totally recovered, but it's definitely a not as negative as it was a year ago.
But the year hasn't come without its challenges.
No, I mean, there are definitely still problems at Uber. I mean, there are still regulatory hurdles. London was an important step, but the company is, you know, in some ways under even more scrutiny than ever before, because you're seeing regulators in cities all over the world really starting to take steps to address the issues that the growth of ride hailing has brought. So you've seen New York do this. They recently passed a one-year cap on the number of private hire vehicle licenses that the city gives out. Those are licenses that the companies like Uber and Lyft need to operate. And, you know, there are still places around the world where Uber hasn't been able to enter and to operate. They still face a lot of opposition from taxi unions. Another big business challenge is competition. I mean, this industry hasn't gotten less competitive. Uber is the market leader in a lot of places, including the U.S. But, you know, its big rival in the U.S., Lyft, is also pretty well capitalized. And that forces Uber to spend a lot of money recruiting drivers, making sure that they have incentives to keep drivers on their platform, because it's actually really easy to drive for multiple car services. And so, you know, Uber wants to make sure the drivers are spending more time driving for them, and also to win customers. And that gets expensive because they're basically subsidizing fares. So that's something that's really, that's still affecting the company. You see in their financials, they're still making losses. One of the hallmarks of Dara Khosrowshahi's tenure has been more financial discipline, and he has reduced some of the losses, but you know, they're still a long way from profit. And then there are some outstanding legal issues. These federal investigations haven't gone away. There's investigations into a bunch of matters, including price transparency. Just this year, we heard about a new investigation into gender discrimination. So those are all going to be overhangs. And some of those are things that, you know, that well predate his tenure, but he still has to deal with how the company's going to respond, whether they're going to have to settle or how they're going to react to these various allegations.
And what about the culture? How has sort of life inside the company changed?
Well, you know, there have been really positive changes that people say have been made. You know, the company isn't immune from continued issues. Its head of HR stepped down earlier this summer after allegations over how she had handled some complaints from employees. And in a case that actually hit a lot closer to home for Dara Khosrowshahi, his chief operating officer, who is a key part of his team, he hired him. He brought him. It was somebody he knew from his time in Expedia. His name is Barney Harford. He was accused of making disparaging comments about women and minorities. And now he's still at the company, and Mr. Khosrowshahi says his whole executive team has undergone training on diversity and inclusion, and that's become a real priority for the company. But it still shows that, you know, A, there's still work to be done on the cultural front, and B, everything that happens at Uber just happens under such intense scrutiny, which I think is an overhang from all of the drama that's happened in recent years that's going to continue for the foreseeable future.
So you're talking about myriad investigations, regulatory battles, and this issue of profitability. Each one of these legal issues eats into the margins. What does Khosrowshahi say about how and when Uber might be able to turn a profit?
One of the things that that Dara has made pretty clear is that investors shouldn't expect profitability anytime soon. He's tried to really guide away from that expectation. What he has says is he wants to demonstrate a path to profitability, because his argument is effectively that there are markets where Uber is profitable. They don't tend to disclose them, but there are areas of their business that are making money. But all that money they're taking and reinvesting into other parts of the business, and they see that as really, really important for growth, for competitive reasons, to diversify. And so, what he's spending a lot of time on these days is talking to investors and the broader business community about his vision of what Uber is going to become, which is a real expansion from its origins as a car booking company. So they've added bikes onto their app. So you can go in several cities in the U.S. and soon in Europe, you'll be able to rent a shared bike. They're also going to add scooters in. He's made a deal with a company in the U.K. that does public transit payments, because they want Uber to be the place where you can pay for your subway fare. They're also diversifying into food delivery, which has been a really successful business for them. They have a new freight brokerage business. So it's this idea that Uber isn't just about cars. It's about transportation of all kinds. And it's about being a central place that people are going to come every day to that app on their home screen and use it no matter how they want to get around. And that's what they see as their real competitive advantage, that they have scale to roll that out. And they also see that as the only way you can really break into what he says is the ultimate competition, which is not Lyft and other ride-hailing companies, it's car ownership.
And so I guess this is the foundation for that massive valuation of more than $60 billion that these investors, including the likes of SoftBank, they're betting on Uber leading, or at least being at the front lines of an entire new way that we're going to be thinking and conceiving of transportation. So Shannon, if this past year was about cleaning up and bringing order to Uber's operations, this next year is about getting ready to IPO. Just last week, they made an important hire to start that process.
That's right. Uber finally hired a CFO. They had been without a chief financial officer since 2015. And it was something that Travis Kalanick, as part of his real disinterest in IPOing, didn't really make a lot of effort to address. But that was something that when Dara Khosrowshahi came in last year, he made a real priority. He has said it took him longer than he wanted, but he did hire a CFO, Nelson Chai, who has a background in finance, was previously CFO of Merrill Lynch and of the New York Stock Exchange. And so he's in place now, which is an important step for the company. It means they can now sort of move forward on getting from their discussions that they want to have an IPO in the second half of next year to actually making it happen. They'll need to hire bankers. They'll need to start putting together the pitch to investors. And then, of course, they'll ultimately have to go out on a roadshow and sell the company to the public market. So all of those will be developments that will be happening over the coming months.
So if we think of Uber under Travis Kalanick as the sort of first wave of Uber or Uber 1.0, a period of growth at all costs from culture to those regulatory hurdles, and now with Dara Khosrowshahi at the helm for, say, let's call it Uber 2.0, and some lofty goals for disrupting the transportation industry as a whole, can that somewhat more refined, methodical approach that you've outlined, is that going to work? Can the professionalized Uber have as big of an impact as it did under Kalanick?
Yeah, I mean, it's this sort of question of how do you keep being that disruptive sort of startup force or retaining that energy while also with dealing with being such a dominant player within this specific part of the industry. You know, I mean, I think Dara's answer to this is they are still seeking aggressive growth. They're still going to make big bets on not just the core transportation business, but things like autonomous driving and on flying cars, all these things that they've been pouring money into. And they see those as really important to retain, future competitive advantage. But I do think there's more of a sense now that they also have other constituencies whose interests they need to balance, whether it's the cities that they're operating in and where they're seeing the impact of, what it means to have this many cars on the street and how to work with regulators to deal with that. And of course, you have to remember that actually affects Uber's business too. If it takes a long time for a car to get somewhere, someone might not want to take it. There's making sure that employees feel that they are, working in a sustainable business that's going to be there for the long term. So I think the kind of the next generation of Uber really is kind of looking at itself as a more mature player, but that can also retain some of that burning startup growth while starting to show actual returns on those investments.
So, as we look toward 2019, Uber's intended timeline for the IPO, does this mark a kind of tonal shift for Silicon Valley more broadly if we look at the sort of the generation of one-time unicorns that have now become these multi-billion dollar tech companies?
I mean, you've seen so much more focus in the past year on this question. I mean, CEOs are addressing it directly. Airbnb has talked about, a broad timeline for going public. Lyft is certainly also in the mix when people talk about the companies that are most likely to go public next. So I think for this generation of companies, we may be coming to that point. Of course, there's, a whole new generation of new unicorns that are kind of being minted every day that still can, I think still see a long path to being able to raise money and build their businesses on private investment. You've seen a record number of over $100 million fundraising rounds this year already. And so, I think that while it will be significant and important that some of these biggest private companies do go public, there's not going to be any shortage of appetite to stay private for a lot of the rest of Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm. It might just be Uber's turn to graduate.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Shannon.
Thanks, Amy.
You can read all of Shannon's dispatches from Silicon Valley on FT.com. And let us know what you think. If you've got an episode idea or feedback on the show, we really want to hear from you. You can email us at behindthemoney@FT.com or tweet me at Amy P. Keene. That's A-I-M-E-E. And if you are enjoying Behind the Money, it would really mean a lot to us if you could take a minute to rate the show and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find out about us. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.